spent 5 years in Chicago at the Fermilab, then the university. Then she went back to Cambridge on a Royal Society Fellowship, then up to Durham University, where she now holds the professorship. She's very well known for the Gregory de Flamme instability. That's with Raymond de Flamme, who is also here in Waterloo. She got the Maxwell Medal from the Institute of Physics in 2006 for her contributions to physics at the interface of general relativity and string theory. And today she's going to talk on detecting extra dimensions with gravitational waves.
Thanks, Lucy. So hopefully, I mean, I know the Psi students in the audience will not be surprised if the technology comes crashing down on me, but I'm hoping this is going to work. So I used to work on cosmic strings when I first did my PhD, and in fact that was the problem that Ray and I looked at. We were thinking about cosmic strings in higher dimensions, because Ray was also a student at DAMT. But then I kind of wandered off and did other things. But I knew when I moved to the States that cosmic strings were definitely, you know, definitely cool when I was sitting there watching Star Trek The Next Generation, and Captain, it's a cosmic string fragment. So that's the meaning of this, the little picture on the front page. Except I'm not sure how well it shows up. So just as a setting, before I kind of move on to the talk proper, in a nutshell, basically what the topic I'm talking about today is something in on string cosmology, or specifically brain inflation. And essentially you've got these two juggernauts in theoretical cosmology and theoretical particle physics. On the one hand, you have this paradigm of inflation, which is incredibly successful at explaining the origin of perturbations in our universe, and it's widely accepted, mostly thanks to the WMAP data. However, if you're going to be nitpicky and come at it from a theoretician's perspective, there is no unequivocal accepted theory of inflation. There are many models, but nobody will actually say this is the theory, this is what happened. So it lacks a robust foundation. On the other hand, we've got string theory, which is somewhat more founded in terms of the, you know, the theoretical side. It's definitely powerful, it's generally well accepted, though I should probably think perhaps this is the one audience I would be talking to where there may be more skeptics than in most. But it's, again, a big industry. However, it sort of has a particular glaring absence, which is it has failed to make a single prediction that's been measured. So it seems like, you know, they were made for each other. And indeed, in the past decade or so, well, more actually, I suppose, but it's come particularly to the fore in the last decade. These come together in this model called brain inflation. Usually string theory has had a bit of an uneasy relationship with cosmology, but here there is some setup, some scenario in which you can describe inflation, and it just so happens that one of the side products of this process, this model, are these cosmic strings. So that's the setting, that's the subject of the talk, cosmic strings from brain inflation. So as an outline, I'll start off by making some general statements about brain inflation. I'm not really going to explain precisely how it works, because that's not the focus of the talk. The focus is on the strings produced and how they might be detected. And so I'll then move on to, I knew I'd do that. I'll then move on to actually reviewing cosmic strings. So what I'll do at this point is actually go back in time, a bit like Back to the Future, back to the 80s, and talk about the old-fashioned cosmic strings, because a lot of the intuition we have comes from these simple models that were developed in trying to understand cosmic strings initially. And then mention perhaps a few things that are the same or different with these superstrings. I'll then talk about the gravitational waves, try and explain a bit about how you calculate the signal coming from events on the string. It's a bit of a sort of long and quite involved calculation, so I'll just try and sort of pick out the salient points, and then talk about these events, or sort of isolated, either completely rare events or isolated points on the string, which are in some sense extreme, and you'll see what I mean when I get to that, which are associated with a particular signal in the gravitational waves. And then I'll talk about what the difference is when you bring in these superstrings, which come along with the notion of having extra dimensions. So I'll sort of describe what would have happened if you were doing this calculation with the original cosmic string model, back in sort of with four dimensions, and then talk about the effect of the extra dimensions, which is the work that we did. So, as a sort of background motivation, I'm talking about extra dimensions. Why should we believe in extra dimensions? Well, initially we had Kaluza and Klein, who were trying to unify electromagnetism with general relativity, and they did so by incorporating the gauge group of electromagnetism very directly. They added an extra dimension to space-time, an extra spatial dimension, which was a little circle. And they found that if you looked at gravity in this five-dimensional space, it rather naturally became a product of four-dimensional gravity, electromagnetism, and an additional scalar. So roughly speaking, your four-dimensional gravity is just what's going on anyway in your four-dimensional space. The electromagnetism is associated with motion around the extra circle. And then the scalar has a nice interpretation as just being the size of the circle. This is gravity, so our geometry is very fluid, it can change, and therefore this internal circle can change size. So this idea was introduced quite a while ago, and it was very rapidly realized it couldn't explain the universe as it was, mainly because of this scalar, that it didn't seem to make sense cosmologically. There are a lot of limits on the existence of a scalar. However, it hung around, and more recently, it's sort of come back to the fore as a means of hiding extra dimensions. Kaluza and Klein hide the extra dimensions sort of by sweeping them under the carpet. They make them very small. Nothing depends on the extra dimensions. On the other hand, there's a different way you can hide extra dimensions. You needn't make them small. You can make them actually as big as you want, provided you make yourself, us, our standard model particle physics, stick to some slice, four-dimensional slice, in some higher dimensional space. So this is this concept called brain worlds. Just as a reminder, a brain, we use this term to mean an extended object. So a zero-dimensional object, as far as we're concerned, a zero-spatial dimensional object is a point, it's a particle. A one-dimensional object is a string. Two-dimensional object would be a membrane. And then, of course, as you go up, if you've got more dimensions, you can have higher-dimensional extended objects. And so you have to, you know, we don't really have a language to describe that. And so we pick out the brain bit of membrane, and that's where that terminology came from. Initially, I think there was an argument about whether it should be M-brains, N-brains, but I'm very glad that, at least for a while, Paul Townsend won the argument by producing a paper called Super P-brains, which I think is much nicer phrase for an arbitrary dimensional object. So that's where the term comes from. So you'll hear about brains all the time. I'm thinking of the Psi students here. But that's what it means. It's just an extended object. And in the brain world sort of picture, we live on one of those extended objects. We live in a four-dimensional space-time, but there's nothing to say that there might not be extra dimensions hiding out here, but we can't see them because we're glued onto this four-dimensional slice. So again, not very visible. On the left is a sort of representation of this, a Nintendo character, Mr. Game & Watch, who's meant to be some old character from the 2D days of computer gaming, who's interacting with a three-dimensional world. So that's sort of another way of thinking of the brain world. Of course, string theory is full of brains. String theory, if we believe it, tells us we have to live in 10 or possibly 11 dimensions. So, you know, we're sort of being led to this idea that there are lots of extra dimensions, and there are actually quite a lot of these objects called brains. So although at first sight it looks a bit odd, having one of these slices and being glued to it, in fact it isn't. These sort of objects are fairly ubiquitous, not just in string theory, but in all walks of physics. As you'll see, the cosmic string is just simply a one-dimensional brain. So in brain inflation, in one slide, so this is obviously going to be very schematic, we imagine that we have some extra number of dimensions, six dimensions, say, which are all sort of screwed up in some very complicated way, but there is one of these sort of regions where there's a lot of space-time curvature, and we have our brain moving in these internal dimensions, but it's extended in our four-dimensional space-time. So we're living on one of these brains and kind of moving through this internal space, and our position here on the internal space is a scalar as far as our extended dimensions are concerned, and this is the scalar field in inflation. And so the general picture is inflation ends when basically one of these brains has rolled down and met its sort of its soulmate and decayed. So here's the movie. I swiped this from Paul Steinhardt's webpage, but I deliberately didn't loop it round so that it became a cyclic universe. In fact, I truncated it. So the picture is you've got some brain and an antibrain, and it annihilates, but it doesn't quite disappear completely. It is possible during the annihilation process that there is something that remains behind, a little wrinkle, if you like, saying that things haven't been quite properly matched up, and that's one of these cosmic superstrings. So the details of the process about how this brain and this antibrain meet and annihilate can at times give you some little defect or wrinkle left over, which is the cosmic superstring. And so that's really, you know, it's a setup. I'm just trying to motivate why we should be looking at these objects and thinking about how they move. So let me get to what a cosmic string is. So I must admit, when I saw the snow, I thought that maybe it would only be the Psi students that would manage to make it here. So I added in a couple of extra slides because I gave them a sort of taster talk a couple of lectures ago about cosmic strings and black holes. So here is the old-fashioned cosmic string. It's essentially some sort of defect in the vacuum of our universe. And it's usually modeled by the Abelian-Higgs model, using the Abelian-Higgs model. And essentially you can get a string whenever you have a vacuum which has some non-trivial winding. So here we're thinking of some quantum field theory, but if there's any condensed matter people either in the audience or listening at any point, they're going to recognize this anyway as a model of superconductivity where phi is the order parameter, and there you would get vortices. It's the same thing. It's basically the same modeling. So normally if you were just looking at the Higgs mechanism, you wouldn't really be interested in the fact that there was a whole sort of set of vacua that you could choose. You just pick one of them and quantize around it. But what we're thinking of in terms of cosmology or in terms of the cosmic string is we're trying to sort of think more globally, and therefore the fact that you have a choice here of what your vacuum is important and can have a consequence. So if you go around, if you allow yourself to move around this circle, in other words, to alter the choice of phase of the Higgs field as you walk around, say, in space, it's possible that if you go on some closed circuit, some little walk in your space, that if you follow what you're doing in the field space, you've actually wound around this vacuum manifold. And if you do that, you will see that you cannot unwind your field without going over the middle. If you go over the middle, you've got energy density. And so that's the string, the energy density. So this is a picture of what it looks like. Here I've chosen the phase of the Higgs to always be pointing radially outwards. And so you're winding around the vacuum as you go around the origin on the plane. And so as you move in on the plane, you will see that by continuity, you have to at some point leave the vacuum and go over the middle. Get an energy density, that's your string, so, or vortex, whichever way you want to think about it. Why will they form? Well, if you think about it from the point of view of the early universe, you're at very high temperatures. One of the things that happens is that the effective potential is altered at high temperatures, and so you go through some phase transition at some point where you go from a symmetric phase to a broken symmetric phase. And because you're dealing with some generic process in the early universe, it is entirely possible that you might drop down to different vacua in different regions. And so you will, in general, pick up these windings that you can't get rid of. So you form these strings during some sort of phase transition. And again, people from condensed matter will be very familiar with this. If a defect can form during a phase transition, it generally will. So that's what these old-fashioned cosmic strings were, at least within this model. Just to get a feel for the numbers involved here, typically, well, I've made the point they're protected by topology, but typically the width and mass of these strings is set by the scales of the particle excitations if you were looking at the quantum theory. So in the case of the abelian Higgs model, it would be set by the masses of the gauge and scalar bosons. So a standard grand, if you formed these things at the sort of from a grand unified theory, typical numbers might be that the mass of 100 meters of string would actually be about the same as the mass of the Earth. So these things are incredibly extreme as objects. So how extreme they are depends sort of how close to the Planck scale they're formed, or the physics that's associated with their formation is. So just a small point, because we kind of need this as intuition for the strings in a cosmological setting. They're either infinite, or in our case, they go across the Hubble horizon, or else they're closed loops. I thought I would just be strictly correct by saying they can end on black holes, but we're not going to worry about that here. So how do they evolve? If you want to think about how they interact gravitationally, you need to sort of have some notion about how they move. So I said that they were modeled by one of these abelian Higgs vortices, but in general, that's the field theory. That's got lots and lots of degrees of freedom. And you don't want to have to deal with all of those. You don't want to carry that baggage around with you. So what you do is you make an approximation. You say that, in fact, as far as we're concerned at cosmological distance scales, the string has zero thickness. And so we don't care about the details going on in the core of the string. So we'll integrate them out, and we'll get ourselves an effective action, and we'll use that instead. So when you do that, you find that you end up with something called an AMBU action, which is simply saying that the action of the string, effective action of the string, is proportional to the area of the world sheet swept out by the string. So this is, of course, quite familiar. It's one of the ways of writing the superstring action, though not the one that gets used. But you see the same sort of phenomena coming up with these essentially classical objects. They're sort of macroscopic, they're solitons. But, you know, they have similar kinematics. So the loops, or indeed the infinite string, have left and right moving waves. That's what the excitations look like. They've got left movers and right movers. And if, you know, you can look at the equation of motion, if you're sort of suitably crafty about picking coordinate choices, it looks like a simple wave equation. And so you can write things down in terms of, here, sort of basically two position vectors of the left and right moving components. So your very own Neil Turok, actually, was one of the people who developed this formalism in conjunction with Tom Kibble. And basically, Neil had David Olive as a supervisor at Imperial College, and David was one of the sort of first generation, the original sort of Star Trek type string theorists. And Neil obviously had been set on something, you know, quite formal as his PhD project, but he, in typical Neil style, sort of took that knowledge and exported it out to this new area of thinking about these defects, these topological defects in cosmology, which Tom Kibble was interested in. And so they developed this formalism for how to solve for the cosmic string motion. And so this position vector here, which is given in terms of a sort of A and B, as a left and right mover, has, when you put in the gauge constraints, you see that the derivatives of the A and the B have to lie on a unit sphere. So that's called the Kibble-Turok sphere. So here's an example on these two I've chosen because they illustrate the phenomena that I'm interested in, kinks and cusps. So hopefully it's going to be the next slide. Good. So the string can have a sort of wrinkle, a sharp profile. In general, you know, you've got these waves traveling along, but occasionally they can interfere constructively, and you get something which is called a cusp, where the string instantaneously moves at the speed of light. So that's like it's a single event, it's instantaneous, but it's quite extreme because the string's moving at the speed of light. A kink is far more common, and it's something which persists, but it is exactly a kink in the string, a little wrinkle. So both of these are associated with some sort of breakdown or singularity in the description of the string. The cusp is where the A prime and B prime curve cross, and the kink is where there's some actual gap in one of them. So why would you get kinks? Well, kinks happen because of a process called intercommutation. If you've got one of these vortices, generally it's sort of sloshing all over the place, it's moving highly relativistically, and it's actually quite common for it to self-intersect, or maybe for two different strings to cross each other. And then what happens when these two objects cross each other is quite interesting. They don't just ignore each other and pass through. It turns out that when they cross, they have a tendency to swap partners, or what's known as intercommute. So this is, again, quite common with solitons. There's a sort of, usually there's this 90-degree scattering property when you collide two of these solitonic objects together, and that's what this is related to. And again, if you look at physical systems which have these defects, these vacuum defects, and look at how once you form the defects, how they evolve before they eventually sort of usually dissipate and annihilate each other away, you do see this process happening. You quite often see these things sort of, you know, curling around and cutting off in this form. And so when they've cut off, they leave behind usually quite a sharp kink on the sort of, in this case, what we call a daughter loop. Then, if you want to think about the gravity of one of these general loops, you can use this Nambu action, find the motion, plug that back into the string, through its energy momentum and use linearized gravity to calculate what the gravity wave is going to be. And so what you find is the loops gradually radiate away and produce a sort of standard general gravitational wave background, but these isolated events, the cusps and kinks, produce a particularly distinctive burst or signal that has a somewhat different character to the general background produced by loops just sort of slowly losing their energy and radiating away. So when you put all this information together, how strings behave when they cross, how they intercommute, the fact that they gradually decay because of the gravitational radiation, and the fact that the universe is expanding as well, so that's also stretching out the network. But of course, as the horizon increases, more and more string also comes in to your horizon, then looking at all of these effects together gives you, you can sort of do a computation of what happens to a network of strings. And what people found was that in an expanding universe, the strings essentially were found to scale. So that means that if you looked at different times in the evolution of the universe, the network would look approximately the same, but scaled up. So the length of a typical loop is roughly proportional to the sort of cosmological time, and the density goes down roughly like T cubed. That's in a particular model, sort of semi-analytic model for the network. So if we want to think about how we would verify or refute this setup, we have to think about how we might detect the strings. And because the core is so small, they're basically detected via gravity. Not much happens from a particle physics point of view. So there are three ways in which they leave an imprint. The first one is that if you look at now an infinitely straight string, I said these things were horrendously heavy, 100 meters had the mass of the Earth, you might expect this is going to really produce some very strong gravitational effect. However, the string also has a tension running along its length, which kind of counterbalances the energy density. And it turns out that they do have quite a strong global effect, but they don't give any tidal forces locally. So what a string does is it cuts out a wedge in space-time. And so it produces a space-time that looks like a conical deficit. So you can find this by actually using the Abelian-Higgs model as your sort of candidate cosmic string, writing down the coupled Einstein-Abelian-Higgs equations and just solving them. And you see that you get this conical effect, but with, of course, a smooth apex, snub-nosed cone. So this cone will produce gravitational lensing. It'll produce double images if your string lies precisely between you and some distant galaxy. And so people are always looking for double images, and there have been one or two potential candidates over the years, but usually on closer scrutiny, they've found to be just two very similar galaxies that just happen to be very close in the sky. The other way cosmic strings do leave an imprint is on the microwave background. So initially, strings were put forward as a sort of counterpoint to inflation, some alternative, that these strings, obviously being very massive, if you had a loop, far from the loop, it would be attractive. And so matter, it may be these loop-seeded galaxies. However, if you look at the perturbations that a network produces, then you find that it is just completely at odds with the ringing of the microwave background, the power spectrum. So it was rapidly realized that strings just could not be responsible for the formation of structure in the universe. And the CMB does rule out strings at to be too much, they can't be too dominant. It's around 10%, I think, of if you wanted to use them as part of a structure forming model, they certainly are below the 10% level. So roughly speaking, you've got a bound. This mu is the energy per unit length of the string, and you can bound that at the sort of 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 7 in Planck units. What I want to focus on is the gravitational wave background. So obviously at the moment there's been no positive detection of gravitational radiation, but we are hoping that once Advanced LIGO gets off the ground, and certainly when eventually LISA gets going, we're actually hoping that's going to change. So maybe we can find some signature of cosmic strings in gravitational waves. So that's what I want to move to next. Good. So here's our little GIF of a gravitational wave. Remember, a gravitational wave is just a distortion of space-time. And it's a quadrupole nature. It's a tensor object, so we have distortions that are either a sort of a plus or a cross polarized. So again, just as a reminder, LIGO and LISA are going to be operating or looking at different frequency ranges. And so when we want to look at what our cosmic strings predict, we have to kind of look in the right frequency window. So I'll outline the calculation. We want to calculate what the gravitational wave effect of these strings is. Now, this was done originally by Vilenkin and Vachaspati, but about 10 years ago, there was a sort of tour de force calculation by Damour and Vilenkin, where they went over the original calculations, were careful thinking about gauge choices, and picked off the gravitational wave signal and amplitude that was the physical measurable one. So that's what I'm going to describe. It's their method here. And so if you look at the wave equation, and essentially Fourier transform it, you can see that in the far field, your waveform is going to be well approximated by a sort of 1 over R type of behavior, plus a sum over the Fourier modes. Now, generally, for just a normal sort of loop that's not doing anything extreme, you find that most of the radiation is really just in low frequencies. There's not a lot of high frequency radiation. However, for a cusp or a kink, it turns out the special features about this doing this Fourier integral, and it gives you a sort of high frequency power tail rather than a sort of exponential damping of the signal at high frequency. And so this gives you a sort of characteristic signal, and it's something that you can then use to kind of estimate whether you've seen an event or not. And so this, you can calculate the energy momentum from the coordinates of the string world sheet, and you find that looking at this integral, it splits into a sort of left-moving integral and a right-moving integral, which is great because on, you know, the formalism, the Kibble-Turok sphere, you've broken things down into a sort of left-moving vector and a right-moving vector. And so you have some hope of actually going in and looking at, you know, the behavior of these integrals explicitly. So if you have, say, if you think of the cusp, you have a point where the two cross, what you can do is expand your integral around that particular point and then actually do this integration. And what you see is that either of these integrals, when you've got a sort of combination which is looking at the wave vector of the string motion versus the gravitational wave vector in Fourier space, and if those two wave vectors align, then you get this constructive effect in the integral and the power law fall off in frequency. So these integrals, if you have wave vectors aligning, have a power law fall off. Now, of course, there's two. There's a left and right mover. So in general, if, you know, if there's only one of these, you know, if your A and B are in different directions, there's no way your gravity wave vector can align with both at the same time. So, but you can see that if the two come together, then you get this enhancement. So the cusp, what happens with a cusp? The cusp beams out when you do this. You see that there's this very strong alignment when the gravitational wave vector aligns with the two, the left and right moving wave vectors, which is sort of orthogonal to the, if you think of this as literally a wave about to break on the sea. Then when these align, you've got a very strong enhancement of that integral. And you find that, roughly speaking, in a cone, and I've sketched it here as a sort of spatial cone, but don't forget, this is the gravity. We're talking about space and time, so a little bit to the past of when the cusp forms and a little bit to the future also is, you know, the cone spreading out in time as well. This cusp is sort of beaming out very strongly gravitational radiation, sharply localized in a little cone. And the opening angle of the cone is defined by the saddle point of the integrals that you find when you go through a fairly tedious computation. And so the waveform of the cusp has this particular format. It's proportional to this mu, the energy per unit length of the string. Well, that's good. You'd expect that. If the string's heavier, it should be radiating more. It's proportional to the length of the string. That comes up in terms of sort of typical scales of the wave vectors. This is the step function. It's telling you about the opening angle. The opening angle of the cone is also related to the length of the loop and the frequency. And then you've got the 1 over r and this frequency dependence. The kink, on the other hand, is kind of a little more subtle. The kink is persistent on the string, and therefore it's got to persistently radiate. And if you look at how it radiates, you see that it radiates in something that's a bit like a fan. So it's the kink occurs when you've got a discontinuity in one of the left or right movers, and you've got an enhancement of your integral over the complementary, let's say it's a left mover with a discontinuity, you've got an enhancement of your gravitational wave integral on the right mover, but that is localized sort of, or it's localized less sharply, but nonetheless localized, sort of round about where the discontinuity is. So it really does look rather like a fan. And then the fan itself, of course, opens out in this sort of perpendicular plane as well. And that opening angle is defined in a similar way to the opening angle of the cone. So here again, you get your G mu. You've got proportional to the mass. So the length comes in. But notice it's a different power of the frequency. There's a sharper fall off for the kink than there is for the cusp. And that's basically because the cusp is a more extreme event. You've got a sort of dual saddle point of both the left and right moving waves. They're constructively interfering. It's a stronger effect. So cosmologically, you've got to translate this calculation, which is done for a single event on a single loop in flat space, into the expanding universe. And so there are several things you've got to take into account. You have to allow for the fact you get redshifting, cosmological redshifting, the frequency. Then you've also got to take into account the fact that your distance, you know, what do you mean by 1 over r? Well, what you actually mean by 1 over r is the sort of cosmological distance, which is your scale factor times the co-moving coordinate r. And that scales again with redshift. So again, you've got to factor the usual sort of redshift factors of 1 plus z times the angular diameter distance. So this is what your what your R coordinate translates to in terms of a cosmological quantity. And that's just for one event. Then you've got to estimate the total signal from the network. So in this case, what Damur and Vilenkin did was they talked about a detection rate, event rate, n dot, and then looked at how that n dot varied as you move back in time, so as you move in redshift space. And so here you can see sort of various the distance to the events. This is actually a sort of volume factor. If you move a little bit incrementally back in redshift space, it's like your 4 pi r squared dr, except translated into cosmology. And you see the properties of the network coming in this factor here, which Damur and Vilenkin called nu, which is telling you something about the expected number of events. So the expected number of events is going to be something to do with the density of the network and also the number, you know, the number density of the network and the length of the loops. So that's the sort of rationale for these terms here. So T is telling you about the length of the loops. P is an object which is telling you about density. I talked about intercommutation and said that the strings always intercommuted. Well, that's really for the original cosmic strings. I put that in here because I want to use the same formula for the superstrings. One of the first differences you see with the cosmic superstrings is that they don't always intercommute. You can think of it intuitively as them missing in the internal dimensions. And if they don't intercommute, it means that the network gets a wee bit more tangled, and so it makes it denser. So that's, if the probability is less than one, this goes up. So that's roughly what's happening there. Then C is telling you something about the number of events per individual loop. And so this is going to be a number that's going to be important in a short while when we move to the superstrings. So Damur and Vilenkin basically put it of order one. So as I say here, this theta squared is just the cone angle. It's a volume, you know, the size of the cone. So you imagine that there's been an event at some redshift z, then it's going to sort of have the theta, you know, an opening angle, which kind of goes, spreads out through the universe. So you have to go through and calculate all that lot. And that's what Damur and Vilenkin did. It's one of the densest papers, actually, I think I've probably ever gone through. And they did all sorts of approximations. They used that because they wanted to not have to do too much numerical integration. They used analytic approximations to things like cosmological time, the scale factor, and so on. And then their sort of method of doing this was they decided that they'd like to look at what happened if you asked for one event per year, and what would the amplitude of that one event per year be. So this is this, so that you would integrate up here till you got to the right event rate of one per year. And then you find this integral is really dominated by its high redshift behavior. So that gives you, you sort of say, well, okay, that event happens at that high redshift. And then you go back and look at the amplitude of that high redshift event to get what the amplitude is. So that's what they did. And here is their, well, logarithmic amplitude scale. So this means 10 to the minus 21. So these are the typical numbers that they're trying to look at in LIGO, in advanced LIGO. And they found this plot. They plotted alpha, essentially, against amplitude and showed that there was these characteristic curves. Here were cusps where you got one cusp per loop or one cusp every 10 loops. And then kinks. So the kink amplitude at the LIGO frequency range is somewhat suppressed. So you've got your rate, you put in the peak optimal frequency for the detector, which was 150 hertz for LIGO, I think, and then you calculate this amplitude. So that was what they did, and that was the state of the art. But they were using all of this four-dimensional sort of cosmic string intuition or folklore. So what's the effect of extra dimensions? So now moving on to the work that Ghazal and I did with collaborators Emer O'Callaghan, Sarah Chadburn, and Yvonne Zavala. So what I'm showing here is a little animation of loops where all I've done is I've changed one of these loops, which is the red one, I think, has a little bit of motion in the internal dimensions. So what happens is that when you add extra dimensions, your string can move in those extra dimensions as well as in the non-compact dimensions. And that means that it's effectively slowing down from our perspective. And that actually changes things quite a bit. So it not only reduces the probability of this intercommutation, as I already mentioned, but it actually reduces the probability of cusp formation, and it changes, it not only sort of affects the form for the particular signal for an individual event, but when you do the cosmological integration, it changes that, the details of that as well. So I'm going to try and sort of get across the spirit of how this happens so that when I put up the alternative, when I put up the alternative graphs, you'll sort of have some idea of where it came from. Right. Okay, so what happens? First, let me deal with cusps. So when you've got the, essentially the waves along the string slowing down, it means that the wave vectors of the left and right movers are no longer necessarily null. And so what that means is that the cusp, it's not going to be traveling at the speed of light. So the cusp rounds off. And that gives rise to, you have to now decide, what do you mean by a cusp? In the sort of pure Nambu 4D picture, you knew exactly what you meant. It was where the world sheet traveled at the speed of light. But if the world sheet never reaches the speed of light, how do you decide when you've got an event that is going to be significant enough to produce a gravitational wave? So you have to define something called a near-cusp event, where in terms of these wave vectors of the string waves, the left and right movers, those two wave vectors come within a certain amount, which we call delta. And so if you get one of these events, so the minimum value of mod A prime minus mod B prime is 2 delta. So here's a sketch of what happens. The cusp is rounded off, and the cone is narrowed. So it's two effects. You don't get the thing going at the speed of light, but it can beam, but the cone narrows. And so what we had to also estimate was the reduction of probability of these events. So it's not just the events are less powerful, they're also less likely to occur. So in three space dimensions, the Kibble-Turok sphere is a two-sphere. You have two curves on the two-sphere, which have to be sort of weighted around the origin. They're always going to cross. So your probability is essentially one in three space dimensions. If you go up even one dimension, the Kibble-Turok sphere is now an S3. Two curves do not have to cross. So that's partly why you've got this near cusp rather than a cusp, but it also changes probabilities. So what we tried to do was to estimate the probability of one of these near cusp events. And we looked at the parameter space, so we modeled this by looking at toy loop families. We actually constructed higher dimensional loop families of cosmic string loops and looked at the parameter space in which exact cusps formed, and then we said that the probability of a near cusp would, I mean, so the parameter space in which the cusps form is obviously some submanifold of your total parameter space, and so you have to say, well, how, you know, how much of the surrounding space is, you know, is this near cusp? So, for example, if you've got one extra dimension in your parameter space, which is not forming a cusp, so you're, in other words, your real cusp subspace is of codimension one, then you would expect that the probability of a near cusp event with amplitude delta would just be proportional to delta, because you're looking for a strip around your exact cusp, which is roughly delta wide. And so that's how you estimate it. Similarly, if it's codimension two, it'll be delta squared, and so on. So we knew we were looking for something where your number was proportional to delta to the n, where n was the codimension of this parameter space, and therefore our probability density was just going to be the derivative of that. Now, n here, you find that the codimension of your exact cusp parameter space is actually the number of extra dimensions. And it's simply by saying, looking at the fact that if you want A prime equal to B prime, you've got to set them equal component by component. So there are three non-compact dimensions and a number of internal dimensions. But of course, you've got the coordinates sigma and tau. You can go forward in time or around your string to look for one of these events. So that removes 2 degrees of freedom. And so that sort of that takes you down by two. And then in addition, you know your A prime and B prime have got to have length one. So that's another constraint. So that's three constraints on a system with n plus 3 degrees of freedom. So even I know that n plus 3 minus 3 equals n. So there you go, delta to the n. That's the codimension. We also had to do a little bit more modeling to try and figure out whether there wasn't, you know, the constant of proportionality in front of this thing wasn't so minute that it didn't matter how big n was. So this is an example here where we've looked at a family of loops, the parameter space. So we're looking at a sort of orthogonal, going away from an exact cusp surface, and then looking at delta, the nearest point where the two, where A prime and B prime come. And you do see this is pretty much of order one, that gradient. So we simply set C equal to n delta to the n minus one. So a general network, the final step we have to do is that we say, in general, this network is going to have all slew of all of these near cusp events. So it's going to have all sorts of values of delta, ranging up to where the cone closes off. Delta is something we don't know. We don't want to specify. We want to pick them all up. So what we have to do is we have to integrate over this unknown delta. So here's our near cusp event rate. We've integrated over this delta. This is the sort of corrected or modified De Moore-Vilenkin result, and then we can go ahead and play the same game, do the same things De Moore and Vilenkin did, either by using their interpolating functions, or we can actually use the exact expressions for H and dA for our concordance cosmological model, and just simply do a numerical integration to find the rates. So that's what we did, and this is what we got. So here is the LIGO frequency. Here's the De Moore and Vilenkin in black. And this is for one extra dimension, 3 and 6. And if you look down the side here, you see that we're actually going down about 3 orders of magnitude sort of each time, which is a huge effect. And again, we did the same thing by looking at LISA. And again, there's quite a suppression from having this the extra dimensions. It's actually the biggest effect is the suppression of measure, the probability of forming these things. So that meant we went back, because although our modeling was not restricting the size of the internal dimension initially, although we then looked at a finite extra dimension and actually, to our surprise, found it didn't make any difference. And the reason is that the NAMBU action is modeling the string with a zero width object. And so, you know, when something's zero, it doesn't care whether it's sort of, you know, 10 million Planck units or five, because it's got zero width. But obviously strings don't have zero width, so we wanted to try and model how a finite width might affect this. Intuitively, once the width of the string becomes the size of the internal dimension has to be washed out. So we changed our probability on our probability of near cusp events instead to say, to introduce a parameter delta naught, which was providing this cutoff due to the width of the string. And so that we wanted to say, well, once you've got to delta naught, that's actually the point at which the string has the same size width as the internal dimension, and we want to get rid of that and make it an exact cusp event. And so we put in this new parameter, new measure, and got something which was probably a little bit more believable. Here we've altered, trying to see, okay. So this is actually fixing a delta naught and looking at different internal dimensions. And here I've fixed the number of internal dimensions to be three and looking at how things depend on delta naught. So what you see is that for Lisa, unless G mu is very big, it's all washed out. But for the LIGO frequency range, there is still some, significant suppression. So even if this effect cuts off at some finite, size of the string, you're still actually seeing something happen. So actually, you need a clock in here. It's difficult to keep yourself to time. So just very briefly, I want to just say something about the kink, which is my student Dima and I worked on. Here, this is sort of showing what happens with a fan. Here is the kink on the Kibble-Turok sphere. You've got a discontinuity. You know that the Fourier integral of the gravitational waveform is enhanced along one of these curves, and then because of an edge effect due to the discontinuity, there's a sort of enhancement overall of the signal. But whilst there's a very strong cutoff either side of this sort of transverse to the fan, as you go around, you see that there's also a localization so that it is a genuine fan. The sort of signal does peak quite strongly as you go between the discontinuities. So that's what it kind of looks like. And then you go through the same sort of calculations that De Moor and Vilenkin did, but you end up with a slightly different dependence on theta. And when you add in extra dimensions, you find that the only thing that happens you've got to take care of is the thinning of the fan. There's no measure alteration. And so this is independent of the number of extra dimensions. It's just a geometrical thing. The fan gets a bit thinner, and you have to integrate over that. And so what you see is that you do see a suppression. So here is, here you've got the dots of this numerical integration, and the lines are using interpolating functions. But the suppression is somewhat less dramatic than it was for cusps, and it is dimension independent. So I just want to sum up, since I know I'm out of time. What I wanted to communicate to you is that at the moment, the LIGO data is being used to put bounds on the energy per unit length of cosmic strings coming from brain inflation. Therefore, you need to sort of be sure that you've got that prediction right. So what we tried to think about was what was the effect of having motion in internal dimensions. And we found that that could have quite a lot of different sorts of impact. And in particular, for cusps, it seemed to have a very strong effect. So I also want to point out some caveats about what we did. We didn't really, in these papers at least, think about warped internal dimensions, nor did in terms of looking at the interplay between the motion and the internal dimensions and the external dimensions, did we think about cosmological expansion. So it does seem like kinks offer the best bet for detection, but if you could see one of each, then you would actually, by comparing the amplitude of the kink versus the amplitude of the cusp event, then you would get some information about the number of extra dimensions. So perhaps, you know, you can actually use this to tell you something about what's happening with your extra dimensions. So I'll stop here and open it up for questions.
Do we have questions?
So it's, they're moving, probably have to go right back to the, they're moving in the compact extra dimensions. So they're large in the sense of large extra dimensions, small in the sense of you know, what we think of as being large. So the width of the string is actually going to be at least comparable in the sense of not too many orders of magnitude down from the size or scale of these internal dimensions. So they're big enough that there is a notion of motion in the internal dimensions, otherwise intercommutation would not be affected. However, they're small enough that I think you do need to do that tweaking of the measure of cusps to take into account the finite width of the cosmic string. So one of the problems you have, and thanks to Ghazal I've got this little animation, is of course that the Nambu action is an approximation. It's taking the string and making it have zero width. What you see here is something where Ken Olam and collaborators have done a simulation of the abelian Higgs model. The blue is the thick abelian Higgs vortex, and he set it up such that the Nambu, which is would be in normal circumstances tracking the core of the vortex, that the Nambu motion has a cusp. However, what you see is that the cusp itself is being rounded off anyway by finite width effects. This cloud is a sort of cloud of radiation, particle radiation. However, from the width of the string and the rounding of the cusp, the rounding sort of occurs of order 5 string widths or something. So we did actually check that this effect, this rounding due to finite width, didn't swamp the effect of motion in the internal dimensions. But our sort of setup is, we're going to use Nambu because that's the sort of usual route for looking at cosmic strings. But in the back of the mind, we're remembering the issue that the string really has finite width. That's why we computed the signal for a different number of internal dimensions, because it may be that in terms of the internal dimensions, there's a hierarchy. There's some dimensions are wrapped up smaller than others. And so some will be picked up by the motion of the string because it's thin enough that movement in those dimensions makes sense, but some of them may not be picked up. So I'm not sure it answered directly the question, but I hope it's sort of given some food for thought around it. You mean winding? Well, they are. So if these things are formed by, say, a D3 and an anti-D3 annihilating, then you know that they will actually be one-dimensional, because typically you sort of drop down by 2 dimensions each time you get one of the annihilations. And so in the case of the, you know, the model or the setup that I had, I actually know, or, well, I say I know, I'm not sure anybody really knows, but they, those particular ones really are one-dimensional. Now, again, if you had, say, a three brain with only one dimension sticking out in our universe, I guess what we've been imagining is that we've been kind of thinking, well, that's just sort of used up two of the internal dimensions, and the string is free to move in the others. But you're absolutely right, that could well be a little bit of a different kettle of fish when it came to the kinematics. So we really were thinking of one, you know, the D3, anti-D3 annihilation in this case. Okay, so the reason for not thinking about domain walls, so just for people who don't know, domain wall is just another example of one of these topological defects where you've got disconnected vacua. The reason is cosmology. So cosmologically, we learned when we were looking at these defects back sort of in the 80s, monopoles were, of course, the original rationale for inflation, or one of the original reasons for inflation, because if monopoles were produced, they overclosed the universe. Similarly, if you produced a domain wall network and then looked at how that network evolved, it would generally clog the universe. It did not give a sensible cosmology. And strings, on the other hand, so monopoles kill you because they're too heavy. Walls have an energy, again, a high energy density, but two negative tensions. And so gravitationally, they're actually, you know, a little bit of a problem cosmologically. But, you know, it was the network evolution and thinking about that that was the killer. On the other hand, strings have this really nice property that they gravitationally, they're very finely tuned. So a single string doesn't really, it's not a catastrophe if there's a string somewhere in our universe. It's not going to spoil the cosmology, but a single domain wall actually has quite a strong effect. So it's really coming from thinking about the cosmology. Strings are okay. Walls and monopoles aren't. Yes, no, the modelling we did, which I was sort of trying to point out, I think, in the middle of the caveats, was, yes, we did do a Kaluza-Klein, sort of. I mean, in the sense that we were doing a sort of toroidal type of compactification. So we weren't thinking about the picture that I originally put up. But Sarah, my student Sarah, is sort of continuing to look at this, and we are actually looking at warped internal dimensions, because there's a sort of, or a phrase I've heard coined is that if you have the warping will simply attract the string down to the bottom of one of these throats, and that will essentially turn off any motion in the internal dimensions. But these are some preliminary plots, and that is just not true. If you look at the Nambu equations, it's a lot more difficult because, of course, you haven't got this nice Kibble-Turok formalism. But if you kind of do some simple trajectories and simple modeling, you see that there's simply, you know, that if you're in, if there's no cosmological expansion and you don't take into account damping from gravitational radiation, there's completely elastic flow between the internal and the external dimensions. And actually, if you start allowing for a Hubble damping in your external dimensions, it's even more embarrassing because all the energy starts being dumped into the internal dimensions. So it seems like warped extra dimensions again, this is sort of quite preliminary, but it's not looking like they're going to radically change this effect. So what's going on here, you're asking? Yeah. Okay, so it depends what you're trying to do, okay? So so what Garoch and Trashen did was they were interested in whether you could replace consistently, gravitationally, this vortex, this thick vortex, with the infinitesimally thin Nambu string, a line. Or indeed any line source in general relativity. Because for these domain walls, if you have just one extra dimension, it turns out you can. You can, in fact, replace a thick wall with the same energy sort of squashed onto a hypersurface. So, and you therefore write delta of Z or something as shorthand. But if you try and, if you want to do, so it's basically theory of distributions in gravity, but with codimension 2. And the problem is the non-linearity of gravity comes up to bite you, and they found that there was no consistent way of taking the limit of zero width such that the answer you got was independent of the way the limit was taken. But that is looking for a very specific mathematical question. Here, what we want is a sort of the far field, a bulk sort of effect of one of these loops moving around. So the intuition is going that, sure, the string has a finite width, but as far as we're concerned in this far field regime, we don't really care about that. And so it should be a good approximation to replace this vortex, which is writhing around, with the Nambu energy density in a linearized gravity approximation. The only time that you worry about it is, in fact, at one of these cusps or kinks, which was why we did actually check the effect of the rounding due to finite width. That was what bizarred it. So that's the sort of only point where you might worry about whether what you're doing is a good approximation. But it still remains true that the effective action that I put down is, of course, taking no gravitational back reaction into account. You can do exact gravity solutions of strings, but they've got to be infinite and straight. But we don't sort of have unlike the wall, we don't actually have a fully consistent approximation scheme by which we can, go to order by order in the width. And in part, it's the Garoch-Trashen argument, but also because, we sort of combine this intuition that the string itself doesn't make local vial curvature. So, if all we're doing is calculating gravitational radiation from the loops, it seems reasonable to do one of these linearized approximations.
Okay, we should finish there. Let's thank Ruth once more. Thank you.